ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your...
Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, coming to you today from Airworld, Dan, or sort of Airworld. I'm in downtown Houston at a Hilton hosting a quilting conference. I feel a bit like Elvis starting my Vegas residency in 1970. But that is not the subject of today. We'll discuss that another time, and we can return to that later. Who are our guests today, and what are we discussing?
Well, actually, we are talking about the 70s. We're talking about an exhibit called 1972 Accumulations, the subject of which is the unfortunately recently demolished Nakagin Capsule Tower in Tokyo. The Nakagin Capsule Tower was really the best and largest example of Japanese metabolism built. It was by Kisho Kurokawa, and it had the unique feature of having 140 removable apartment units in modular fashion, which were affixed to two concrete cores connected by a bridge. The exhibit, 1972 Accumulations, is currently running at Moss Context, which is an exhibition gallery here in Chicago. Noritaka Minami is a visual artist based in Chicago. Minami uses photography to examine spaces that exist as anachronisms in the landscape and are overlooked for their significances in understanding contemporary society. In 2015, Kara Verlag published his monograph titled 1972 Nakagin Capsule Tower, which received the 2015 Architectural Book Award from the Deutsches Architekturmuseum in Frankfurt, Germany. In 2022, he was commissioned by the Graduate School of Design at Harvard University to document the architectural works of John Andrews for its forthcoming publication, Architect of Uncommon Sense. He is currently an associate professor of fine arts at Loyola University, Chicago. Iker Gil is an architect and director of Moss Studio, the editor-in-chief of the nonprofit Moss Context, and the executive director of the SOM Foundation. Iker is the editor of books Radical Logic on the work of Ensemble Studio and Shanghai Transforming. He has co-curated or curated the exhibitions Port Architecture, Sergio Priego and Michael Fisak, Nocturnal Landscapes, Bold, Alternative Scenarios for Chicago, included in the inaugural Chicago Architectural Biennial, a gallery as part of the exhibition Chatter Architecture Talks Back at the Art Institute of Chicago, Shanghai Transforming at the Chicago Architecture Foundation and Virginia Tech, and Synchronizing Geometry held at SR Crown Hall at Illinois Institute of Technology. He was the co-curator of the exhibit Columbus 2020-21 and the associate curator of the U.S. Pavilion at the 16th Venice Architecture Biennale that took place in 2018. Welcome, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think the Nakagin Capsule Tower is really, you know, indicative of a certain period of time in Japan. Maybe we could get a little bit of a background about what was going on in the early 70s in Japan and why this unusual looking structure with all these circular fisheye lenses for windows was constructed and by whom.
So the Nakagin Capsule Tower, the building itself, was completed in 1972. But the origin of the building itself, you can kind of date back to 1960 with the formation of an architectural group called Metabolism. And they presented a manifesto in 1960 at the World Design Conference that was held in Tokyo, Japan. That's really the origin of the Nakagin Capsule Tower as a type of like theoretical idea in terms of creating a flexible architecture that consists of both permanent elements and impermanent elements. That was also the debut of the architect of the building, Kisho Kurokawa, in terms of like the public, the limelight or the architectural world. And in terms of Metabolism, they initially presented a manifesto, and a lot of it was presenting their ideas through speculative proposals. Many of their ideas were enacted in limited fashion during the 1960s, but for both the metabolist architects such as Fumihiko Maki and Kikutake Kiyonori and Kisho Kurokawa. The 1970 World Expo that was held in Osaka, Japan was quite a pivotal moment where for the first time their ideas was provided a forum or context in which it could be enacted at a larger scale. And the event was really crucial for Kurokawa's career because he had the opportunity to create three different pavilions at this World Expo. And a lot of it involved using the ideas that he had developed through metabolism, such as using modular parts, capsules, space frames. And through the exposure and the publicity that he gained at the World Expo, he received a commission from the Nakagin Real Estate Company that was based in Tokyo, Japan, to create essentially an experimental apartment complex, which eventually became the Nakagin Capsule Tower in 1972.
Very exciting. And the idea of this was that these capsules would be demountable and that they would be replaced, say, every 20 to 25 years, I think. That never happened, did it?
Yes, Kurokawa initially proposed that the capsules be replaced every 20 to 25 years. I'm not sure if that time frame was necessarily based on like the longevity of the structures themselves, but more about this estimate of like how frequently the capsules have to be replaced in relation to like, say, changes of lifestyles, etc. The irony of the building was that even though it was predicated on this idea of flexibility and movement, not a single capsule was ever replaced during its 50 years of operation. And when the capsules were finally deinstalled from the two concrete cores, it was during the demolishment of the building itself this past summer.
Yeah, I mean, that's terribly ironic, isn't it? Maybe you can describe some of these capsules since we are in audio format here. I will certainly be directing people in the show notes to the exhibition itself so they can see what they really look like. But for the benefit of the listening audience, maybe you can describe how these capsules were configured. They are very much time capsules of the 1970s, even though that wasn't probably the original intent.
So Kurokawa envisioned these capsules as a second home for businessmen or people who worked in the city. So a second home that's away from the traditional home that will be located, say, outside of the city, the suburbs. Each capsule was about 10 square meters, which I believe is about 107 square feet or so. They were all prefabricated on an assembly line at a factory at Shiga Prefecture, which is about... which is in the Kyoto area, Kansai region. So it's about 4 or 5 hours drive from Tokyo. So they were all shipped to the construction site in Tokyo and installed there. The capsules came in a number of configurations, but they were all based on having essentially like standardized components, such as like a circular window, side console units, and many of them also had beds from the very beginning. Sanyo refrigerator and a Daikin air conditioner. So the capsules were not originally furnished with, say, a cooking area or kitchen. But some of the capsules were renovated over the years, and they were they had a type of kitchen unit installed. The thing with the capsules was that Kurokawa always envisioned a capsule to serve a certain type of function in terms of one's daily life. But it wasn't supposed to function like, say, a traditional home that had, like, say, a kitchen, living room area, etc. So he kind of envisioned the rest of the city serving all the other essentials of leading a life. So, say, for example, if you need entertainment or if you need food, other existing facilities within the city would fulfill that. So he saw a capsule as one component of a new type of lifestyle in the city. And in reality, for years, there was a convenience store on the ground floor of the Nakagin Capsule Tower, so that in many ways, that convenience store fulfilled the function of, like, say, a kitchen or even a refrigerator that one would have in a traditional family home. So in reality, you saw Kurokawa's idea being enacted.
Well, and I think also that, you know, Asia being a place with a lot of really crowded residences, very small units, cooking is a little bit inconvenient indoors sometimes. It's often done outdoors and communally. And in places like Tokyo, there's so many restaurants available, so many quick service places, so many convenience stores, vending machines, what have you, that it's pretty convenient to just walk out the door and get something at all hours.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this doesn't really have to do with architecture, but, you know, somebody mentioned earlier that, you know, it's a lot easier, it might often be actually cheaper to just buy, like, food or pre-cooked food at convenience store instead of, like, say, buying materials at supermarkets and then cooking it in a kitchen, in the case of Japan. And also, the quality of what you could get at a convenience store is actually pretty high in Japan too. So there's some practical reasons of why, you know, one would use a convenience store a lot in Japan.
Very interesting. The question I have to jump in, and this might be a bit of a 30,000 foot view, is, you know, is how is over the time you documented it, the tower itself perceived by residents? I mean, it's interesting to me because, of course, by the time of its demolition, you know, there were, of course, efforts to preserve it. And what struck me as very much efforts led by Westerners. And, you know, this might sound culturally naive, but my understanding, of course, is that, you know, the Japanese as a society are much less nostalgic about building preservation, that they're, of course, willing to demolish and rebuild. Dan and I visited the Okura slightly before its demolition, and they built it back almost, built it back better than it was before. So I'm curious, over the time, was it perceived as a landmark? Was it beloved? Was it, how did perceptions of it change over the time you documented it? It strikes, its retrofuturity sort of makes it, like, iconic to us today, but was it iconic in its own time? And how did residents perceive themselves?
Yeah, that's a very complicated question that kind of requires, like, multiple components to respond. But I would say, broadly speaking, there were three types of residents in the capsule tower over the course of, like, say, 10 years that I was involved, or a decade. There were the residents who were attracted to the building due to its say history, design quality, the significance in significance of the building in architectural history. You know, they were clearly drawn to it, and they made a choice to either purchase a unit at the capsule tower or rent it. There were also residents who owned the capsule, say, for, like, a business reason, like using the capsule as a type of office or storage unit, or had bought it for, like, speculative reasons, meaning that, you know, it was a type of investment that was bought at a certain moment in time, or they had bought it because of the potential demolition. And also, there were people who were living there for either practical reasons for their work, meaning that, you know, the capsule was located at a very very convenient location in terms of transportation, or they were living there out of, like, say, economic necessity. For that location, the rent was quite affordable. So there were, you know, even within this idea of, like, residents living in the building, there wasn't necessarily, like, say, a universal kind of viewpoint or perspective towards the building's significance or what should be done in relation to its preservation or restoration. There was a lot of, like, over the 10 years too, there was a lot of debate within the ownership about what should happen to the building. And I think in terms of, like, the reception or the view of the building beyond the residents in, like, say, Tokyo, the landscape of Tokyo. You mentioned that it is kind of eccentric, and the way I see it was it kind of gradually became this anachronistic presence within the landscape of Tokyo, where I think the archival images of the building that was shot in 1972, right after the construction was completed, the photographs taken by Tomio Ohashi, they're really significant because you see the original context of the building. It was a larger structure standing in that section of Ginza district, right in front of the recently completed Tokyo Expressway. It's the largest structure in the area. It looks very futuristic. And many of the buildings around it are, significantly lower. Some of them are even made out of wood. And then when when I first visited the building in 2010, that was no longer the context in which this building existed. It was completely surrounded now by buildings that were completed after 1972, all various heights and various styles of architecture. So it stood out as a strange existence that was both futuristic and obsolete at the same time. And I think that was one of the aspects that made it such an interesting presence in the landscape of Tokyo, and also an irreplaceable one too. And I think in terms of this reception of the building in, like, say, Japanese culture at large, there were people who both recognize its historical significance, and also there were people who viewed it as a type of, like, blight, a type of eyesore that existed in the landscape of Tokyo. So even this, it was definitely not universal.
My understanding is that the capsules that were removed, most were demolished, unfortunately, and some of them were in a pretty advanced state of deterioration, and probably there was no choice. But about 30 of them have been preserved. What is the status of those capsules now, and where are they going, and, how can I get one?
Well, just so there were originally 140 capsules attached to the two concrete cores, and there was an effort by Maeda-san, who runs the Nakugin Capsule Tower Restoration and Preservation Project, until the very end to somehow preserve the building in some form. But the pandemic created a lot of complications for that effort. So ultimately, what he kind of settled upon was to basically try to preserve as many capsules as possible. So Maeda-san, I think, has 20 plus capsules in his possession, and they're now currently being restored at a factory in Chiba Prefecture. And within the 20 plus capsules that he has, a number of them will be transferred over to institution, like museums, for their collection. And also, there will be a number of capsules that are going to be distributed, not necessarily as, like, say, an estate where the interior has been restored and refurbished, but as, like, say, skeleton capsules, so that, say, for example, like architecture schools, they could basically take on that capsule and reinterpret how it would be reused and restored.
Well, that could be very interesting, maybe, because there's still a fascination all these years later with modular construction and repeatable modules and being able to replace and extend the life of a building. And it would be deeply ironic if this building were, demolished and confined to the dustbin without being able to distribute the knowledge of how these capsules were put together and what the concept was. And there's obviously room for improvement. I know they were pretty poorly sealed. There was accumulation of rust and leakage, you know, with all these capsules that were, you know, so clearly there's some value to having them taken off the building, refurbished into a better state, and then sort of being used as an artifact or a teaching tool for the future of modular construction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the capsules, from the exterior, when you were looking at it from, you know, outside, they were in a poor state at the very end. But a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, they were intentionally not managed by or not cared for by the management company that looked over that property. So it was this act of, like, say, intentional deterioration on part of the management company to accelerate their deterioration and to, you know, basically move forward with the demolition of the building. There's that in terms of, like, the lack of care of the capsules at the very end. And also the limitations of the design of the building itself, where it comes back to the idea that, you know, these capsules were never intended to be permanent fixtures. They were meant to be removed. And part of that removal had to do with, like, not only replacing capsules, but also most likely repairing the infrastructure of the building itself, namely the plumbing. And because that never happened over the course of 50 years, that also added to issues in terms of maintenance with the building. I think what's really fascinating about this building and the capsules which will continue to exist in this world is that in many ways, you know, the story of the Nakagin Capsule Tower was kind of going beyond what the architect originally anticipated. And I'm really curious what will happen to these capsules as, you know, they encounter new contexts and new environments, that, you know, they are transferred to new landscapes and new situations. Is this a new, like, a different interpretation of this idea of movement that was a major point of emphasis for metabolism? The capsules themselves was originally conceived with the idea that they will be on the move. Kurokawa performed these experiments with modular units in the late 60s based on the idea that they could be moved around, whether through trailers or through, you know, adding wheels to the modular units. The capsules themselves that were attached to the Nakagin Capsule Tower, they were, again, fabricated at a factory that was away from Tokyo and then shipped on a truck. And then when they were deinstalled from the cores this past summer, they were again shipped, you know, deinstalled on a crane and then shipped over to the factory on a truck. So this idea of movement of capsules is, like, has always been part of its identity. And I think this idea of going to, like, say, new homes is kind of continues that legacy.
Yeah, that's a good point. It really does have a second life that almost fulfills the mission of the first, the original intent. How was this allowed to happen in the sense that the building was already being demolished by neglect, if you will? I know a lot of landlords do this, but technically they're not supposed to, and they can get fined for it, at least in the U.S. I don't know how the rules are in Japan. Was there any concern by the government or by anyone besides, you know, interested activists that this was going on?
One of the photographs that's exhibited in the building shows the state of the bridge that existed at the back of the building, this pedestrian bridge that connects Tower A and Tower B in November 2021. And it shows the bridge in a really bad state that, you know, there was this, like, really shoddy repair that was done with the drainage, but it's hard to tell whether it was done by, like, say, the real estate company that managed the property or just somebody took the initiative to do this repair. But, you know, it's a type of repair that was like really, how do you call it? It's like very shoddy. And it's like, on a visual level, it's quite whimsical, but it's also quite pathetic when you kind of think about the significance of that architectural structure. So, you know, when you have the opportunity, if you have the opportunity to visit the exhibition, it'll be really great for you to take a look at that particular photograph and think about it. But, you know, in Japan, it's specifically in Tokyo, it's very well known fact that the price of the land, the real estate of the land is much more valuable than the building itself. So there is this constant cycle of basically demolishing buildings that are not even that old and redeveloping the land to maximize the real estate value. And Nakagin Capsule Tower was ultimately caught in that cycle where, you know, the real estate value or the potential of that land outweighed the historical value in the eyes of, like, say, the real estate company or people who are invested in that land.
Yeah, that's often the case. I mean, in any market, but Tokyo is one of the more extreme ones. That's true. I'd also like to toss a question over to Iker, too, about the how the exhibit came together and how you arrived at a way of displaying it. You know, you have the assembly of the windows on a grid in a relatively small space, but it really takes advantage of the way the room is laid out. And then maybe you can talk a little bit about the run of the exhibition and any other upcoming events that are associated with it. I think you still have at least one event planned.
We do. We have one film screening about the building in November 16th that will be hosted by the Chicago Architecture Center. So we had worked with Noritaka in the past. We had an event called Mass Context Analog where Noritaka presented his work. This was in 2016. He had published his book on the project. So it was a great presentation, and you know, I'm very interested about in photography in general, but also in people who pursue projects that have this long trajectory and continue to see how they evolve. So this year, the building turning 50 years, and obviously with the demolition, it was kind of like a great opportunity to follow up that presentation and figure out a way to present this in a physical space and see how Noritaka had continued to photograph after he had published the book. So last year, we kind of like used a part of our office space to bring an exhibition by Galen Pardee. And we were very interested in making that space available for projects that even that the size is small, it could bring a larger conversation around them. So to also try to organize a lot of events about that. So I think this was how it all came to be. There is also an strange or curious relationship that Kisho Kurokawa's building, only building in the U.S., is in Chicago. It's the Illinois Center Sporting Club, and that was built in the, I believe, early 90s or 1990s. So there is this interesting relationship between a building that was, you know, demolished and built afar in Tokyo, and then something that was in Chicago and tried to build some of those relationships. So I think that trying to do that was interesting. So in terms of the actual exhibition, there were different aspects that I think Nori and I were interested in exploring. One, and the biggest feature is showing those 60 photographs of the interior of the capsules where you have the same point of view where that central round window was the special feature. And it allows you to see both as a series of spaces and experiences and how those buildings and how those prefabricated units that from the outside you might think that they're all the same and that it's like a homogeneous community, it really is not, and how they've evolved over time. So having the opportunity to see them as a group, but also at a size that allows you to see the details of all of them, that was fairly important. When you're looking at a book, you look at one image and then, you know, you flip the page, you look at another one, but you don't have the opportunity to see those in context. So that was one of the aspects. Another area that we have is a photograph of the facade, probably the most recognizable one from the highway, taken in 2010 and 2021, and seeing that, again, deterioration or how the facade and how the building has evolved from prior of having the netting to the one when with the netting and some of the windows that have been open on the sides and the overall deterioration. And then the third area is more like the common areas, and Nori talked about these before, like some of the breaches, the common areas, the damages through the infrastructure, the lack of maintenance of the infrastructure. And then just some of the areas like the doors and the corridors that are used as storage spaces because of the limitations of the sizes of the capsules. So I think there was this idea of thinking about the building from the facade to the common areas to the individual units.
Thank you for that. And I'll be sure to post the upcoming and existing exhibition information in the show notes as well. So I think I have a kind of a roundup question for you guys. If you had the opportunity to acquire a capsule from Lakagin, what would you do with it?
It would be great to have a capsule. I think also there's going to be a situation, there's going to be a situation where you're going to be able to basically get the design of the capsule and basically acquire the rights to reproduce it through Kisho Kurokawa's office. I'm not sure how that's going to be set up, but I think that's something they're working on in terms of like having that kind of like selling the rights to basically reproduce the capsules. But you know, nothing's better than the original capsule, right? So it would be really nice to have a capsule and set it up at a location with a view, because I think that view from the circular window was really, there's something magical about it, about both this idea of looking at something through that circular window and the type of light that will enter that compressed space. And at the same time, for me, what attracted me to the capsule was the fact that it was located at that particular location. The fact that it was located at that particular section of Ginza District, and you had the view of the city that had been developed around it since 1972, and the fact that the capsule was suspended from the core, the concrete core, and was hovering over that landscape. So my particular relationship of the capsule was the capsule itself and also that particular environment. So it's hard to reproduce that kind of experience, the visual and sensorial experience, without the capsules being at that particular location.
Yeah, the context was important, and that sort of goes against the idea of it being totally mobile and transportable and replicable. What about you, Iker?
Yeah, I love to have one. I think, if I had a backyard, which I do not, I think it would be great to make it available for some type of residences or some type of, way of experiencing living in the capsule, something that makes us think about the building. I think there is like a little bit of an obsession with the shape and the identity. But I think if it's possible to learn about the ideas that came about, about the capsule, I think that would be very interesting. So I love the idea of the museums. I love the idea of the institutions, but also it removes it and it maybe makes it more of an object rather than the idea of community and a moment in time. So I think making them available as a residence is something that you can experience. It would be more interesting. And I think to me, like having it in Chicago, I'd love to either like an institution or a museum to be able to bring them here. There is obviously that connection that I mentioned with the existing building. There is a gallery at the Art Institute of Chicago that is named after the architect, but also Marina City as a building that influenced Metabolist, it's here. So I'd love for, maybe this is a cry for someone in Chicago to make that, or like a pitch for someone to buy it. But You know, I think that connects in with making it very interesting to learn about the ideas that also, you know, buildings like Marina City had and the impact that it had in thinking about the city.
Yeah, I could definitely see it being placed on the Riverwalk somewhere in Chicago, perhaps with a view of Marina City, which was its inspiration, and maybe turned into something that's a little bit of a hybrid where there's some instructional value to it. Maybe there's a diorama or, a poster explaining about the history of the tower. But it could also be a pretty neat bar in the style of the Golden Guy, which is not quite the same neighborhood, but not too far away in Shinjuku. These extremely small bars that have very unique character. And something about the size of this space and the customization that went into all these individual units makes me think that it would be a pretty successful bar/museum, which could fit perhaps two or three people at once.
That would be great. Marina City has a great rooftop, so I can already pitch it to the condo board to see if they want to put it up there.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's actually a great idea. And I think there's a lot of value in, like, not being rigid about what a capsule is or what a capsule should be moving forward, where, you know, even this idea of, like, or this issue of, like, say, the capsules that are going to go to, say, museums, like, should they be restored to their original state? As it was back in 1972, or should it show the type of wear that the space accumulated since 1972? And there's always that kind of like debate about what does it mean to preserve something? What does it mean to restore something? But I think there's something really fascinating about, you know, how do you kind of keep pushing things forward? Meaning that it's not like frozen in history, it's not static. It's not in a state of stasis where you can kind of, you can be very flexible and open-minded about, like, not, you know, being fixated by this idea of, like, treating it as a type of, like, precious object, but how do you keep on being proactive about finding new ways or finding new interpretations of that space? And I think, you know, even this idea of, like, making it into, like, say, a small bar or, you know, that kind of, like, social space, I think that's actually pretty exciting.
Well, perfect. I will get the RFP written up and we're off to the races. I want to thank you guys so much for spending the time with me today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. Tom to Ground Control, I'm stepping